Welcome to yet another episode of Innovation Odyssey. Today, I have with me in the studio Natasha Alexeeva, who is the founder and CEO at Frndly. Welcome, Natasha.
Thank you, Renu. Thank you for having me.
And you are situated where for our listeners?
Well, I'm in San Francisco, California, not quite in the city. I'm in what's called Marine City, which is just across the bay from San Francisco.
And have you always been there?
Oh, I have been all over the place. My journey started on the East Coast in Boston, moved there from Moscow, Russia, where I was. I went to college and was recruited by the U.S. government after college, moved to Boston, worked for them, then got really tired of spending like 9 months of a year in a freezer. So I decided to move to a warmer climate. I moved to San Diego, spent about 5 years there, then decided to go to grad school and moved to the Bay Area. Then continued actually moving up the coast, went to Seattle, worked there for Amazon for a few years, and then came back about 4 years ago to start my company.
Wow. That sounds a perfect fit for the podcast, which talks about the literal journey of entrepreneurs. But what does your company do? I actually always like to do a small elevator pitch of the founder. What do they do? So what does Frndly do?
Well, maybe I'll tell you a little bit about my background, and then it will be easier to relate to what the company does. So my experience is really a combination of deep learning. I spent almost 15 years in the industry in machine learning and deep learning. When I first started, we didn't have any fancy words, and we just called it pattern recognition. So you can see just how long I have been working on this stuff. You know, as I progressed in my career, I worked in financial. I was always interested in regulated industries. So fintech and healthcare is what I know very well. So I ran an innovation team at Kaiser Permanente, which is a large integrated delivery system. And I kind of learned the way physicians think and document there, and how deep learning and AI can be applied to medical records. And then I also worked for Visa, was the director of analytics there. So, you know, did a lot of work with financial data. And then my last gig was with Amazon, AWS, where I was hired to kind of incubate all the machine learning services that are insurance and fintech related. So kind of all these learnings combined led me to start Frndly. Frndly is focusing on digitizing and automating the most challenging processes in the insurance industry, which is underwriting and claims adjudication. Our clients are right now either large reinsurance clients or primary carriers who process a lot of medical data. Medical data is kind of the cornerstone of the underwriting and claims process. So we take all these medical records, digitize them, extract all the risks that are relevant for underwriting, and summarize this data.
You said you like regulated industries. Why is that?
Because they're difficult. They're very, very different from anything else. And I like the challenge. Yeah, you know, regulated industries, besides being able to apply, you know, machine learning, deep learning to this data, it's also not, there is the whole other layer of compliance. You can't just run a model on data and produce the results. You also need to know how to deploy this model in a secure way, how to create a data set that doesn't expose any personally identifiable information. So it's a whole different story from just using machine learning on anywhere else. And of course, healthcare brings an additional challenge of, you know, having this language that we are trying to analyze, physician language, that are not really, you know, natural language. It's physician language. It uses abbreviations, you know, specific codes. And so if you just apply natural language to the physician language, it's not going to work. So all the modern kind of OCR and NLP systems have fairly bad results on attending physician statements. And so that really, I saw that as an opportunity to create something that will fix a problem, not just a technology problem, not just creating a new algorithm, but also really a business model where it is a solution that automates things, but also in a way that is compliant and can be used by a global enterprise.
And do you have a preference between actually the healthcare and the financial services in terms of industries?
Well, in my world, they are often overlap. So we work for our clients are financial institutions, but they process medical data.
Okay. So you're getting the double whammy of regulation.
Exactly. Yeah, it is as difficult as it can get.
The other question I had is that how do insurers deal with this automation? Because we know them. They are a very traditional industry. They are way behind banking. And then you have accumulated skill set that's way ahead of its times, right? So, but when you first started talking about Friendly, did it resonate with the insurance companies?
Well, I'll be honest with you, it didn't. When I first started pitching Friendly back in 2018, it was a very tough sell. There were only a couple companies that actually gave us a chance. And, you know, they worked with us, but it really took some very forward-looking people to help us build the product. That's a big challenge. Of course, we work with people who are still in mainframe, and here we are with deep learning and stuff. And it was a huge gap for them, understandably so. But you know, as time went by, I think the realization was, and another thing is that our clients started seeing some results. And so there was some realization and some, and of course, pandemic actually helped in our case. So there was a bit of a shift in mindset and understanding that we can't rely on people. We can't scale our business. You know, we don't, to me, scaling a business means you keep your expenses the same, but you grow your bottom line. And so, you know, that mentality has started to adapt among our clients. It is still takes time for people to kind of buy into the fact that this can work and give us a try. But I definitely see a lot more companies willing to do that who are, you know, very traditional insurers.
Were your early adopters reinsurance companies or insurance companies?
Both. Actually, our first clients were kind of, it's interesting, they were mid-size primary carriers, so insurance companies. And for them, it was perhaps easier to just try something new. And they were our first clients. And after that, we had some global reinsurers who first kind of just played around because Friendly can be deployed on a private cloud. It wasn't a huge risk for them. They deployed a solution and they experimented with it for a while. And then as they started seeing very interesting results, they, you know, started using us in production. But, you know, that took about 24 months, I would say, from the time we started talking to the time we actually got to being used in production. Very long sales cycle.
So who is the user in a reinsurer or insurer?
Both reinsurer and insurer.
But within the companies, who uses your product?
A variety of different teams. So underwriting teams, of course, anybody who is trying to automate the review of facultative cases or what's called post-issue analysis. Claim adjudicators, R&D teams are actually very big fan of our technology because we provide data to them that they can use to do their analysis. And now even actuarial teams who do use our data for pricing studies.
That was going to be my next question, that, you know, how easy was it for you to have the actuaries to buy in?
Well, we have some actuaries on our team. Yeah, that helped a lot because first they bought into the technology and they started working at Friendly. And so they were able to talk the same language with other actuaries. But, you know, for me, actuaries are incredibly intelligent people. So it was, you know, it was like a win for us to get them to use the product. Yeah.
And it's probably, it's like really a meeting of the minds, talking to them. So can Friendly be used in all over the world? Or is the train only for the U.S.?
Yeah,
setup?
It's our competitive advantage is that we support other languages. And we are deployed right now in the U.S., Europe, Singapore is using us, U.K. and Australia.
And how did you choose these countries? Or did the countries choose you?
Yeah, I have to say the countries chose us. We started working with global companies, so the strategy and really the value proposition of Friendly was that, you know, we wanted to be a global company. We didn't want to be only limited to the US mortality market. And as we started working with global reinsurers, and, you know, for us, first global meant US and Canada. And so this was first we started just working with Canada and processing French, Canadian. And then, you know, we saw that we can do it. And we started thinking about other parts of the world and presenting to other units. And they started trying us and seeing the results. And that is how we, you know, continued building the platform for this, for other regions. We saw kind of, like, for example, we work with companies in South Africa. It's not like that, you know, I woke up and said, oh boy, I wish we had business in South Africa. It just, we saw that it's a very innovative part of the world that's trying to do a lot of stuff. And so, you know, we started supporting Afrikaans and working with the insurers over there.
So how many languages do you support?
Right now, 6 languages.
Okay. And did you build the technical system, or do you, I know you have a team, but did you lay the foundations of building it?
Yeah, a lot of the design was done by me, and then also my technical co-founder, and then we started building the team around it. But yeah, I have a very strong technical background, so that definitely something that I kind of envisioned.
So when there are glitches or when there are improvements, do you itch to fix it?
I do. I definitely still do a lot of testing of the system. I love like using the product and seeing what can be improved and should be improved. But yeah, for sure.
And since you said it's for medical records, is it, what lines do you cover? Workers' comp?
Yeah, so workers' comp, life, disability, supplemental benefits.
The technology, can it be, is it portable to other lines? I know it's medical records, but there is a core that can be applied.
Right, yeah. A lot of stuff we do is actually just general data in underwriting. Right now we're working towards being able to summarize financial data. Essentially, the way we look at it is underwriters are not doctors. So we should help them with processing medical data and give them all the key insights that they need. They are also not accountants. So our next job would be to get everything from the financial data to help them make these decisions faster. And then we go from there. This is, you know, we probably are not going to ever be a generic solution that just processes any kind of data, but we look at what is that that's a true pain point for our user. And then we apply technology to fix that.
So does ChatGPT's explosion, has that helped you?
Well, it you know, we have been using large language models since 2018. It was like nothing new for us, but it drew attention. So in terms of it was a marketing. All of a sudden, everybody was interested in what we do, even though, you know, we have been doing that for a while.
How do the regulators, insurance regulators, react to your automation?
Well, I mean, regulators have to be careful by definition. So they always ask questions. What helps elevate their concerns is our ability to be deployed on their infrastructure, on their private cloud. So that really helps, because we don't ask anybody to send the data to us. Instead, the platform moves in with the data. And so it's usually looked upon very favorably by all the security and compliance teams.
What is your vision for Frndly for, say, the next 2 years?
It's kind of twofold. One is we really want to, you know, our pitch was always that we are the most accurate system in the market. And this is what we want to continue be, because this is where we differentiate is the results. So instead of just going very, you know, wide and trying to do everything, we really want to be specialists in our area. So that one thing, we want to continue expanding into other geographies. So being really well in what we do, we will apply this technology to other geographies. And then slowly we will try to cover other types, like I mentioned, you know, other types of documents, other pain points that we see in our clients. We, you know, have the same principle that I learned from Amazon called customer obsession, where we really listen to what our customers are saying and we solicit all the feedback. And then based on that feedback, we build what we believe would fit in the US and internationally.
I was reflecting on your experience working in such big companies, Kaiser Permanente, Visa, Amazon. Is it because you worked in such big companies that you started a startup?
I mean, the problem that we are solving right now, I saw it everywhere. I actually pitched Amazon the product, but it was, you know, they felt it was too small of a market. So that's why for them, anything that less than $1 trillion is not interesting. So, you know, it just really came from this struggles that I've experienced myself as I was working at Amazon with leaders in different insurance companies. I saw this struggle, and I saw that the product that we had at Amazon was not quite fixing that. And so I knew that if I, you know, take what I know and we implement and we, you know, give it to the industry, it would be very transformative. That was the biggest motivation. I felt that the time was right, and I had the right skill set, and I had the right people around me, like, you know, people that I knew they were interested in the same topic, so I was able to build a team around it. Right now, there's 28 of us.
And are you funded?
We are funded by revenue.
Okay, which is the best way.
It's a challenging way too, because it's, you know, you really only rely on yourself. But I am, and it wasn't really by design that happened. It's just, you know, I realized that it was incredible, much more difficult for me to get funded than for probably a lot of other people. But, you know, I'm kind of glad it happened, because I really know everything there is to know about profit margins and scalability and accounting and all these things that a lot of other founders, by the nature of having access to a lot more resources, don't know.
So. I mean, I always talk about this in my conversations with other female founders. I think that we are in a strange position, right? We are smarter than most people, but it's still so hard for us to raise money. And what do you consider yourself having any positives because you are a female founder? Or at this point, it's just the gender doesn't make a difference in your head?
Well, are there any positives? I mean, you know, as you know, we are unique. That's the best way to put it. There's just not a lot of female founders, and especially in technology. So, and that is both advantage and disadvantage. So disadvantage is because you don't fit into this pattern that VCs are used to. You know, they used to have two male founders of a certain age and certain look, and it is how they think. So they see something else, it's difficult for them. And of course, it's a disadvantage because, you know, I had revenue, I had large clients, and nobody wanted to invest in me. So, you know, that's one thing. But uniqueness can also be an advantage. You know, it also helps, I don't know, raise attention. You know, it's you stand out. And I think it's possible to capitalize on that too, on the fact that, you know, we are unique. So it's all a matter of perception. And I think through the years, I learned to appreciate that more than just having a grudge against it.
Yeah, I hear you. And I have to say that, you know, when I talk to the more experienced female founders, they all say the same thing, that this is where we are now, and we want to make the best of it and build a business the more profitable way. Right, and I am with you completely, but I want to change it, you know.
I agree, but maybe the best way to change it is to prove everybody wrong, right? We have to win. We have to be the best. We have to be better than anybody else. So much better that there is no question that we are worth the investment. So, and that's my focus.
And going back to a little bit to the personal side, do you think that your journey of studying in Russia and then coming here, working in so many places, you think that has impacted your entrepreneurial career?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, I went to school in Russia where education is very, how to say it, it's very grueling. You know, it's very demanding. People go to school 6 times a week, and it's 8 a.m. till 5 p.m. It's all day. It's extremely competitive. It's very easy to get kicked out. You know, I went to school in a, you know, very well-established university. So that kind of, when I came here, it seemed like everything was easier for me. but I brought that attitude of, things are difficult and it's competitive and, you know, we have to solve very complex problems to win. We can just, so I think that definitely helped. But I also went to school. I did exchange programs in other parts of the world, and I think it was incredibly eye-opening. I think it's, you know, that you also spend a lot of time in Switzerland, so you know how it is. You kind of learn different practices and different ways how people think. So it's easier to cross-pollinate and bring whatever you learned from this other culture to your new environment. And that's why I like also hiring people from different countries is just because of the different mindset that they bring to the table.
So do you have like a hiring philosophy?
Yeah. It's for us, you know, everybody is looking for this top-notch technologist. But, you know, the problem with this approach is that what we do is so cutting edge that it's difficult to find somebody who actually has a lot of experience, right, in, you know, medical data analytics. So what I look for is people who do very well on problem solving. Actually, during the interview process, I always ask somebody to answer some problem solving. It's like a little quiz. And it's a pretty generic way to, I think, measure somebody's aptitude to learn. And those are the people that I look for. You know, they have to have technical background. You can't just not have it and somehow become a data. But it's, for me, it's less important that somebody, you know, went and, you know, worked 10 years at Google Brain than it is to see how fast they can consume, process, and learn new information.
Okay. And do you see any cultural differences? And this is just out of my curiosity. Do you see any cultural differences at problem solving?
Yes. I think some people are just, they might be very good problem solvers, but problem solving, you know, it involves kind of this asking questions. You don't just solve a problem in your head. Usually it's this interactive process where, you know, the question is asked and then you kind of see how somebody is thinking. And I see some people are incredibly intelligent, but they are afraid to ask the question. And so they get stuck and they're like, they give up and, you know, and that is maybe like something in the education process where people are not encouraged to be more inquisitive, although they're super intelligent. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I had to ask this because I was rereading Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell, right? And he talks about the Korean pilots and how exactly what you said, that they don't, their culture doesn't let them ask questions or question authority, so they have a lot of accidents. It's, I mean, when I read Malcolm Gladwell, I don't know, 5-6 years ago, I was reading it as a book. And now when you've built companies and you've failures, you kind of put it in perspective. So that was very interesting. And I always have, I started having a trademark question for the show, which is, are you an entrepreneur or an innovator?
Well, so I'm sure, is there a history behind this question? Because how do you differentiate between the two?
Well, I think that this is, so the history is, it was actually in the pilot episode, it was asked to me by the person who kind of helped me launch it. And that was the first time I heard the question, and I really got thinking about it. So there is no definition. It just depends on how you see yourself and how you define entrepreneurship and innovation. And I love the question because it's so open-ended.
Well, you know, if I define, because innovators are somebody who are the very first ones to do something. And I think I learned from my experience that if you're the very first one to do that, it's unlikely that your timing is right. It's like everything still needs to catch up to actually give this an actual business opportunity, this cool idea. So I guess I will more, by that definition, I would think of myself more as an entrepreneur, because it's not that I just want to build something that's totally new. I actually want to see people use that.
But then if you have, since you are successful already, it can help you now be an innovator according to your definition, right? Because you have the track record now.
Yeah, it's that's why I love partnering up with other startups. because somebody's always thinking about something new, and it can be very cool and interesting, and maybe it's just not there yet, but you know, we can and the problem with startups who have a very cool idea but no market is that they either need to be extremely talented in raising money, because they will need this money to survive till the market catches up to their idea, or they need to find other ways of surviving, you know, somehow by revenue. And both things are very difficult. But I think if you are partnering up with somebody, you can bring this idea in. You know, we have an established product, and we can bring in small pieces that can help another company that might not have, you know, access to this clientele to kind of try out their product and maybe survive, you know, really survive for a longer period of time till the market understands what a genius they are.
Yeah. It's very painful, but
yeah,
there is nothing as good as being on time, and that's just so hard.
Oh, I totally agree. Yeah.
And maybe on that note, as we go towards ending, what is your vision for automation in insurance?
Well, I don't think automation will ever replace a human. You know, I don't think it will replace a doctor or an underwriter or a claim adjudicator. My vision is to help everybody become 85% more efficient. So they can really, you know, what I call, they can practice on top of their license. They went to school, they're intelligent, they have experience. They shouldn't be sifting there and looking, what's the income? Is that 50 or 40, you know, or what kind of impairments they have? They should have all this information presented to them so they can use their experience and intellect to make a more complex decision. And this is where I really see the value of the automation, not just replacing people, but helping them be better.
And that's your insurance 2.0.
Exactly. Yes.
Fantastic. That's such a great note to end the podcast. And thank you very much, Natasha, for sharing your thoughts with me. I'm sure our listeners would love it, as I do.
Yep, thank you, and thank you for inviting me, and very good to see you.
Same here.